From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 7th with the publication of a piece in the Washington Post titled "Daniel Prude's Death is a Nightmare Scenario for Black Families Like Mine." The author, Sabah Muhammad, was writing about her brother, who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia in 2007. She writes, quote, "As a young black man with severe mental illness, his interactions with police are doubly fraught with peril," end quote. According to a nonprofit called the Treatment Advocacy Center, 7 U.S. states require a person to pose an imminent threat, an immediate risk of death, or serious bodily harm to themselves or others before being involuntarily hospitalized. Muhammad writes that at the same time, police facing an imminent threat can constitute legal justification for using deadly force. A widely cited 2015 study from the Treatment Advocacy Center reports the risk of being killed during a police incident is 16 times greater for individuals with untreated mental illness than for other civilians approached or stopped by officers. Coupled with implicit bias, the situation can create the perfect storm for what can become tragic situations, those like that of Daniel Prude. This is just one example of the barriers to care faced by people with mental health issues, especially people of color who struggle with those challenges. The barriers are deeply rooted in systemic issues like generational poverty and structural racism. They affect physical health outcomes, too. In the Finger Lakes region, the life expectancy for people living in the greatest poverty is 8 years less than that of people living in the least amount of poverty. So what can be done to remove these barriers to care? How can we create more culturally competent medical systems for communities of color? A newly formed collective of black and brown providers has made it its mission to do this work. The Black Healers Network is a group of black licensed health professionals and mental health providers and community health advocates. And we're joined by members of the collective this hour to talk about their work, their goals, and the impact that culturally competent care can have in physical and mental health outcomes. This is about the Daniel Prude case, but it is about a lot more than that. And I'd like to welcome our guests. Khadija Tillman is the owner of Sankofa Family Counseling Services, PLLC. Khadija, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello to Felicia Reed-Watt, who is has an MS in Health Administration, a psychotherapist, and a leadership coach. Felicia, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Dr. Celia McIntosh is a psychiatric nurse practitioner at Webster Psychiatric Medicine and holds an array of titles, DNP, RN, FNP-C, PMHNP-BC, SCRN, CEN, CCRN, CNRN. I'm Dr. McIntosh. I might have missed a few letters, but I deeply appreciate the time.
Wow, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Glad to be here.
Dr. Linda Clark is with us, the Senior Health Advisor at Common Ground Health. Dr. Clark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask all of you to kind of give us the broad outline of why we're here. But before I do that, let me go ahead and read part of a letter from the Black Healers Network, a statement and an open letter to Rochester City, county, state, and national elected officials that went out regarding some of these issues. Let me go ahead and just read. We, the undersigned, a broad collective of black licensed health professionals, mental health providers, and community health advocates, are writing in response to the murder of Daniel Prude and the fact that mental health and addiction challenges are an ongoing concern within black and brown communities. The death of Daniel Prude at the hands of the Rochester Police Department could have been avoided if appropriate de-escalation and mental health crisis management responses were in place. And then you go down and list a number of actions that could decouple the mental health crisis response from law enforcement, and we'll be talking about that. But let me ask all four of you. I'll start with Dr. Clark here. Is there any doubt to you, Dr. Clark, that Daniel Prude would be alive today if better policies and practices were in place?
Well, absolutely. You know, everything about Mr. Prude's death screams structural racism, from the fact that he took any substances at all to the treatment that he received as a result of taking said substances. You know, the problems are deep and wide and have been cultured over centuries. So it's going to take some stepwise work to get to the roots of them. But at minimum, we need to start by making sure that people of color are treated with respect and with culturally appropriate means.
Well, Dr. McIntosh, there are still listeners, mostly white listeners in the category I'm about to mention, but still listeners who see the story of Daniel Prude, and they say, okay, I don't see where it's about race. I see the breakdown in what happened, but is this about race? What do you say to that, Dr. McIntosh?
I definitely think race plays into it. Just to piggyback off what Dr. Clark said, that we know that there's issues of longstanding, deep-rooted health inequalities related to social determinants of health. We know about the structural inequality, and we know that when we look at this scenario, we can think about system failures in communities of color. There's been a lot of different news reports in media outlets that have, you know, showed comparison of, you know, similar things like Daniel Prude's response to someone that's, you know, a white person. So, I mean, so they have to look at the big picture. Like I said, there's been, and oftentimes if they're not looking beyond, you know, what they're seeing there, then they're not going to see that component. But race does have a big, it's a public health problem. It's an issue for mental health. And if, you know, they are paying attention to a lot of what's going on, not just here, just in the world, they will see that it, when you have that comparison, that there are different treatments for Caucasian individuals or just people not from communities of color.
Well, Felicia, one of the important themes we've been hearing from practitioners, especially lately, is that racism itself is a mental health crisis. How do you see it?
I agree. I think racism is equals trauma, which is a mental health crisis. It takes a village to heal. When I think of trauma, I think it takes a village to heal. And when I think of Black trauma, our Black and brown bodies trauma, I think it takes a village of healthcare providers, Black healthcare providers, and Black and the Black community to come together to help heal.
Khadija, how do you see it?
Yeah, so I definitely believe that racism is a public health crisis in general. I mean, all of the data we have supports this. Just looking at the COVID-19 pandemic alone, it's really highlighted the health disparities existing in the Black community. And then as far as mental health care, you know, while Black people in general are equally susceptible to mental health issues, we're less likely to enter the mental health system. So there's something about the care that our communities are providing that's not reaching Black people, people of color. And this creates a situation where we're not able to receive care. One of the things that I've been looking at in my own personal research is the assisted outpatient program that we have in New York State. So the assisted outpatient program is a program under Kendra's Law. So Kendra's Law was a law that was created as a result of a person who was pushed into the subway and died. The person was pushed by a mentally ill person. And from that, we created the assisted outpatient program. So there's specific criteria that needs to be met for an individual to have a significant mental health issue, repetition in hospitalizations and or jail visits potentially related to the mental health issue. And the individual has to be perceived as dangerous or violent to themselves or someone else. So in looking at New York State's statistics, so we know that mental illness, major mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with psychotic features, so this is these disorders impact the population equally. So there's no, you know, racial indication as to whether someone will or will not develop these illnesses. However, in New York State, Black people, as well as the Hispanic, the Latinx population, are significantly more likely to fall under these mandates of treatment. So basically, it's, you know, mandated treatment. You're mandated to outpatient mental health treatment and also makes you susceptible to easily be admitted to a psychiatric institution against your will. So there's no, I just don't understand the discrepancy in, you know, if these illnesses impact the population equally, why is it that people, black and brown people are more likely to be under these orders? So is it that we're perceiving that black and brown people are more violent than our white counterparts? So there's all kinds of discrepancies and concerns relating to the mental health system, as well as our health system in general, in our country, in New York State, as well as our community here at home.
Well, let me follow up that point with you, looking at one of the recommendations from the Black Healers Network regarding the decoupling of the mental health crisis response from law enforcement. This is one of the most common refrains we are now hearing, whether it's Free the People Rock, whether it's the Black Healers Network or other demonstrators. And they point to research. There's all kinds of research indicating that the vast majority of quote-unquote police calls are for nonviolent situations, and yet armed officers show up. And so let me go ahead and read exactly what the Black Healers Network writes about this. Number one, change New York State mental hygiene transport law by removing the requirement of police presence in response to or transport of someone experiencing a mental health emergency. End quote. Khadija, is this a case where it's, is it pretty simple or is it more complex than that? I mean, I ask because those resistant to this change, usually in law enforcement, but not always, say it's more complex than that. When police show up, you don't know what a dangerous situation is. You do need police in certain situations. Tell me where you see the line here.
Sure. So I don't think that we at the Healers Network, we're not necessarily saying that police would never show up or that communities or our community can't come up with some other form of force and or protection needed for certain calls. But the issue is that as the law is written, police have to show up to any mental hygiene arrest. And we know that that is not necessary. It doesn't feel like there should be a requirement for a law officer to be present in a mental health situation. So we're, when police show up, you're just automatically criminalizing what is a health situation. It's not a legal situation. And this is also the perception, my anecdotal experience in working with people, this is the perception of people, you know, I'm calling for help, you know, I'm feeling unsafe, I want help, but then eight police officers show up at my door. It doesn't feel like a health situation. And you know, as noted, we're not saying that there's never a situation that won't require a law officer or some other peace force or protective force, but it just doesn't need to be for everything.
Okay. Felicia Reed Watt, how do you see that? Felicia, if you might be on mute. I want to make sure we got you.
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I agree with Khadija that it is not a legal, it's not a criminal act to be mentally ill or to have a mental health crisis, and that in the beginning, police may not be there, that the community can be there, that trained community providers can be the first line for someone who's having a mental health crisis.
Okay. Dr. McIntosh.
I agree with that as well, but I also wanted to bring up that, you know, one of the other statistics that I've seen here is that Black and African American people with mental health conditions, specifically those involving psychosis, are more likely to be jailed or imprisoned than any other races. So this also perpetuates everything that's going on. But I definitely agree with Felicia and Khadija there that, you know, maybe not in all instances there needs to be that officer, because, you know, it does seem more legal when, you know, there's a lot of anxiety. I can't speak for every Black person, but there's a lot of anxiety with just being Black. And, you know, when you have that prior maybe bad experiences with law enforcement or stories or previous trauma in itself, then that's oftentimes what you're seeing. So you're these individuals could also be being re-triggered and traumatized just from that encounter, even though they are there to, just be of assistance. So, yeah, I would definitely say that that's another consideration.
Okay, Dr. Clark.
Yeah, I'm the non-mental health provider on the call, but I definitely support my colleagues and I support this statement. Nobody would consider doing that with a person who's in diabetic ketoacidosis, right? I don't understand. To me, it's stigmatizing, and it's treating mental illness like it's not another type of illness in our bodies. So I definitely support doing what we would do for the physical body. We would pay attention to providing help that from someone who's trained to treat the physical illnesses in our body. So it makes perfect sense to me that if there is a crisis that's based on in mental health or substance use, you would call that specialist. You would call that person who's trained to do that. So. To me, it makes perfect sense, and I'm glad to see that the police would take a back seat to the people who are trained to handle that type of crisis.
And Dr. Clark, we just saw a number of local churches working together. We heard last month from Dr. Sean Nelms from East High that there was going to be a number of Black leaders working in conjunction with schools, with churches, trying to work with, you know, if you can speak monolithically about a Black community, in this case, what Dr. Nelms is saying is the Black community is largely more distrustful of the medical system because of all these poor outcomes over the years, because of these disparities. Let me read some data from the Pew Research Center. According to Pew, and this is data from this year, the percentage of United States adults who have a great deal of confidence in medical scientists to act in the best interest of the public, 45% of Hispanic Americans, 43% of white Americans, 35% of African Americans, and the percentage of American adults who have a mostly positive view of doctors, medical doctors. 75% of white Americans, 68% of Hispanic Americans, just 61% of African Americans. And so you've got these churches now working together in Rochester to offer flu clinics, flu shots, and coronavirus testing, assumedly over time, if and when there is a vaccine for COVID-19, you'll probably see the same sort of network and outreach. And Dr. Nelms tells us that's vital because of these numbers, this lack of trust. How do you see this, Dr. Clark? I mean, have we earned this lack of trust, and how do we build it back?
No, yeah, absolutely. I think that it is not just some paranoia, and I hate to use mental health terms because my colleagues will probably correct me, but, you know, this is rooted in truth. You know, there have been hundreds of years of abuse of Black bodies in this country, and physicians have been part of that. There have been inhumane experimentation that has gone on. Everybody knows about the Tuskegee syphilis trials, the abuse of Henrietta Lacks and her body. This is grounded in truth, and the truth is still present. You know, very recently, when medical students were asked, they thought there was difference between Black skin and white skin. Black people don't feel pain the same. Black skin is thicker. We still have a lot of our labs that are based in race, your kidney function. When you get it, your results back, they report it two ways. This is one number for white people. This is one number for Black people. But we know that our kidneys are not different. So there's lots of truth to the problems that people have with medical institutions and medical practice. And, you know, that is why, you know, it's very important that we continue to educate, obviously, But it's important that we have people that are reflective of the community treating the community. You know, I'm the president of the Black Physicians Network, and our mission is to help reduce health disparities and improve the health of community by increasing the number of Black physicians. Because we know that when you have Black nurses and Black doctors and Black social workers and Black mental health workers, they have a different connection with the Black community, and the same with other people of color. So I think, you know, with this big project that we have going on with the COVID testing and the flu immunizations, it was really important that we get the Black and brown clinicians out there to help support that and help talk to our community about the importance of doing both. We can, unfortunately, it's a heavy lift, so we definitely need our white allies, but we needed Black clinicians leading the effort.
Dr. McIntosh.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. And as a member, a founding member of the Rochester Black Nurses Association, I would also echo that, you know, something that Melanie Funches says, the community know what the community needs. We know that African-Americans are 13% of the overall population in the United States, but only 8% of the nursing workforce and 5% of the physician workforce. So what we need in terms of how do we build trust? Well, we need people with both theoretical knowledge and lived experience at the table designing, implementing, and evaluating programs and interventions if we really want to eliminate these disparities. So therefore, you need to have, you know, clinicians like Black and brown clinicians at the table when you're talking about policies, when you're having these conversations about making your protocols or just your hospital system more inclusive. We can't be left out of the narrative. So we have that experience. So that's one of the ways that we definitely have to be a part of that change. And in terms of barriers, we definitely overall have to destigmatize mental illness. When we talk about distrust of the healthcare system, organizations need to be held accountable. They need to figure out what's going on in their systems, why is this happening, but there needs to have that conversation. If they don't have the conversations, then this is not going to be on their radar, and then they're not going to do anything. And people need to really talk up about these issues because they're happening, and there's a lot of undocumented incidents where people don't report because they're just tired of being overlooked. They're tired of being marginalized. And oftentimes that makes someone not want to go to a healthcare provider. Therefore, you know, when they're actually coming in, they're in the later stages of being diagnosed with things, or the fact that they're being misdiagnosed, then of course that's going to create trust. So we have to hold these organizations accountable and do a deeper dive in looking at the all these structural issues and dismantle them.
Felicia, the Tuskegee story is one that everyone should read and understand. The lasting decades-long impact on certainly Black communities who may have distrust of a system. But, you know, it's 2020. Daniel Prude feels like it's causing distrust of a system. There's a lot of events. What do you see as the right kind of steps to build back trust?
I think the right kind of steps, again, is having Black people at the table, both professionals and people that have lived experience at the tables of making the policies. So I think that's important. I, as a mental health therapist and one who works in the mental health system, I think having more counselors and therapists of color is important, or having more counselors and therapists of color is really important, because Black and brown people mistrust white therapists. They don't believe that they can be there for them 100%. They don't believe that they hear them. They leave their meetings feeling invalidated, sometimes unheard, or even dismissed when they're talking about what's going on in their family or in their community dynamics. I think that we need to be at the table. Again, we Black people know what is needed for their community.
Okay, Khadija?
So I agree with the statements of my colleagues, and I will add that I would love to see organizations and agencies make a real commitment to hiring black and brown health providers into their system and creating a space where providers feel comfortable and feel safe, because organizations also perpetuate racism. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know about Felicia, but I have had a lot of clients over the course of my career where I'm counseling them because of workplace racial bias and stigmatization within the workplace. You know, people just don't feel safe. And so I would really like to see agencies take a real effort in addressing these issues of implicit bias and cultural competence training, and not just put, you know, people of color at the table, but really listen to what is being said and be mindful and implement the recommendations that are being made and not ignore. So that's what I see a lot. You know, I see a lot of like placating, like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's true. But there's no real effort to offer any meaningful trainings to make healthcare better for people of color and the workplace better for people of color so that we want to stay.
Let me grab our first phone call, and it comes from Melanie Funches. It's always great to hear Melanie here. Go ahead, Melanie. Nice to have you.
Hey, it's good. It's good to be. It's good to be able to call. And I love what the Black clinicians, the Black Healers Network, is saying. But something that I want to say in reference to this is that, in reference to emergency response, we need to reevaluate and reimagine how we keep each other safe. Because when we're talking about policing and police being involved, we're talking about the safety of the responder. Are we really talking about the safety of the person being responded to? Mm-hmm. And so if we figure out ways that maintain the dignity and honor and safety of everyone involved, that opens us up to a different kind of response that is not criminalizing in any way. And I also want to talk about, in reference to what do we need to do to rebuild trust, this is not a one and done. You know, when I begin to see that organizations not only have more black people at the table, listen to their recommendations, do the trainings, but also have things that are show that anti-racist behavior be part of evaluation. In employee evaluation, in the way that when organizations go for funding, that they are not only they have to address it in their response for funding, but in when they're evaluated, if they're going to keep their funding, and that they invest not just in bringing more black and brown people, but they invest in the training, ongoing training and coaching of their non-people of color, their white staff, in culturally responsive practices. Because you can't just, you know, say, oh, we're going to do this one implicit bias training. That's why people say implicit bias training doesn't work, because you've sent people in the room for 2 hours and say, oh, my God, my biases are not there anymore. This is just because we've been on a 400-year journey for people to fully realize our humanity. And that is why, you know, it takes more than a day to get it right.
Dr. McIntosh, can I have you jump in on that one? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, like I said, there's been longstanding issues with inequality, and it's going to take work. And I agree with Melanie that it's not going to be just, you know, just one hour, 8 hours. It's going to be, you know, people need to be reevaluated. They need to have these conversations. They need to be uncomfortable, being uncomfortable, and it needs to be from the top down. It can't be, you know, organizations putting people in diversity and inclusion roles and not being and not having them being empowered to do anything. But, you know, the administrators also have to take on these roles and do the hard work and stick to and have these policies and reevaluate them, just not leave them like that. And then evaluate the patients that they're seeing and how are they, you know, viewing what the lens that they're looking at these providers through. So there needs to be a real approach to this. And I agree that it can't just be one and done. There's going to be a lot of work that needs to be put in and a lot of unearthing of things, but there needs to be that support at the organizational levels to make these changes.
Well, maybe Dr. McIntosh and Melanie Funches, let me just follow up with one question for you. Melanie, are you still with us? Can I ask you a follow-up here?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you was, I have a note from a retired police officer who asked to have the name withheld, who said that I'm all in with more mental health workers and better treatment. But you know why police go to some of these calls? Because often EMS wants us there. I'm curious, which of your guests have responded to a call for a man covered in blood running around naked without the police? Let's get more help, but let's not lose the sense of reality, but I'm listening. So that's from a retired police officer who's saying that often EMS does want them there, Melanie Funches. And if the Black Healers Network is heeded, if the calls are heeded by government and if others, organizations like Free the People Rock and many others, some members of city council, if they have their way, we will see these steps taken. Is there a concern, Melanie, that some of these situations that, you know, mental health responders or EMS would want police and that it is more complex? Or do you see it differently, Melanie?
I think the wrong question is being asked.
Okay.
When they, it's not do they want police, it's do they want to feel safe. So when you, so going back to my original comment, we have to reimagine how do we keep everybody safe. You know, so my thing is, if we figure out ways to keep everybody safe, that is, the police are not the only people on the planet who keep people safe. And for communities of color, they really don't always keep us safe. So we need to start to reimagine. The reason they say EMS wants them there, because that is what EMS has been taught, they need to keep them safe. If they were taught that they call fire and fire keeps them safe, they would want fire. It's what we are taught, right? So why don't we dream another dream, try imagine a different reality where we have multiple ways to keep everybody safe.
Dr. McIntosh, what do you think?
I agree with that. And the reality of it is, from my perspective, I mean, you really want the greater good for everybody. You do want everybody to be safe. But, you know, everybody has their lane that they have to work in as well. And what we're basically saying is that we need to be a part of that so that we can bring that perspective in that's not being looked at, that's not even being talked about. And I think, you know, when we're talking about specifically the healthcare organizations, they have the capacity. So like I said, they need to do a better job in, you know, having us at the table so we can bring in these different perspectives. But yes, I totally agree with my colleague.
Melanie, it's always good to hear from you. Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you.
Melanie Funches joining us, and some of her colleagues are with us for the hour as part of the Black Healers Network. You just heard Dr. Celia McIntosh, a psychiatric nurse practitioner at Webster Psychiatric Medicine. Dr. Linda Clark is a senior health advisor at Common Ground Health. Felicia Reed Watt is a psychotherapist and leadership coach, and Khadija Tillman is the owner of Sankofa Family Counseling Services. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we've got much more of your feedback for our guests next. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I should tell you what's coming up on Monday, though, is a very important conversation on this program. We're welcoming Jackie Ortiz, among others, from the Board of Elections, talking about what we can expect for voting security, what you need to know about mail-in ballots, and more. We're going to answer all of your questions and make sure everyone is ready to vote in the way that you feel best, and that is Monday on Connections. Also want to mention to you, coming up in about 20 minutes here, Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley has called a 2 p.m. news conference regarding the conclusion of a New York State Board of Elections investigation. It's expected that she will address her office's investigation into alleged campaign finance violations by Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. So we're going to have live coverage. We'll be reporting on this throughout the day on air and online at WXXINews.org. But that news conference with the DA, 2 p.m., so about 20 minutes from now, and we will carry it live. Let me get back to some of your phone calls. Josh in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Josh.
Hey, Evan. I have a question here. It's not necessarily directed towards a specific guest, but I guess more of the scenario. I'm in agreement that we need to change and reimagine law enforcement. I am fully on board with that. I guess where I come in as a little skeptical, though, is if we're going to send mental health professionals on the front lines and have them be the tip of the spear in certain situations, how do we assess that? I mean, basically, it all starts with the dispatcher, right? A 911 call. How do we determine and get that situational awareness from just a phone call, and whether or not it's just the mental health professional that's needed, or both, or you know, a police officer? I guess I don't quite know how to phrase the situation, but I remain a little skeptical on that part about how we initially get there. How do we figure out what the situation is when it's, you know, usually a phone call from somebody who's in distress? Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, Josh, thank you. And I don't know who might be best to kind of direct that to, but Dr. McIntosh is a member of the PAB and also a nurse practitioner. So I'll start with you, Celia. Do you want to take that?
Yeah, I'll do that. So I guess when Josh mentioned that, I was, you know, thinking that initially maybe there needs to be some kind of pilot project so you can evaluate the calls that are coming in and see the accuracy of when you actually get on in the field or to that to the call. You know, so I would say that maybe there's going to need to be some kind of process initially, maybe some kind of pilot project on how to even how that looks. You know, are the calls that are coming from the dispatcher accurate? You know, once you get to the field, if they're not accurate, how do you give that information back? How do you evaluate that? What processes need to be put in place so you can maybe gain more information in the call if things are being left out? And I think from my perspective, I think that's how we would probably have to start, trying to see if we can get the best information, you know, and being able to bring that to evaluate that process. And if we're missing a lot of the information in those calls, what can we do to kind of streamline that or beef that up so that we're getting accurate information? So as we go forward, perhaps then the process is more fluid. So those are my thoughts, but I'm welcoming other thoughts from my colleagues.
Well, and it sounds to me, Dr. McIntosh, like, you know, I think everyone concedes that this is maybe not going to be the kind of transition to how we respond to these kinds of calls. The transition isn't going to be seamless or easy overnight. It's going to take some work to figure out some of the nuance. I mean, I take that point. I don't think it sounds like you're proposing that it will be the snap of a finger. But it does require buy-in, I think, from a lot of different actors in the community. And I hope, Josh, that did answer your question. I mean, it's... We're going to see, and one of the things we're working on, and what you might have heard last night in our live forum on WXXI-TV, was the number of different approaches that are out there in different communities, even different countries. This is a time to learn and to evaluate what we're doing and what others are doing and maybe what works or what we could do better. I want to get Carol in Rochester as well on the phone, who's got what I think is an important point that we need to keep in mind here. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. I've been thinking about how expensive getting an education in mental health would be, and I really feel that it would be beneficial if the local universities like the U of R would start to offer scholarships to Black and Latino applicants so that they can get this this kind of degree so that they can be hired. My daughter just got a mental health degree in Washington State, and she has $100,000 in debt. So, you know, I think this ought to be put to the U of R and other universities in the area.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Carol. Let me ask all of our guests to weigh in. And as I do that, let me remind you some of the data here that was shared in our live forum on WXXI-TV last night that was produced, I think, just so capably and importantly by Megan Mack and a whole team there. According to data from the American Psychological Association's Center for Workforce Studies nationwide, roughly 4% of psychologists are Black, 6% are Hispanic, 4% are Asian. It's just a massively white field. And so what Carol is saying is representation matters, but also it's going to be harder for communities that haven't had the same access to wealth to get six-figure degrees. Khadija, how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely love the idea, and we certainly have an issue with recruiting, you know, black and brown providers in mental health as well as general health care. And as I noted earlier, and probably similar to the caller's statement, there just needs to be an investment in these things from everybody, agencies, organizations, colleges. Everyone needs to wholeheartedly buy in to the need for dismantling these systems and reimagining the way that we treat our mentally unwell people as well as black and brown people within our community.
All right. Felicia?
Yes, I totally agree with Khadija is saying, what the caller is saying. And I would also like to point out that you just don't need to be a mental health professional or a healthcare provider to go out into the community to help the community. Everybody can get training at different levels. And I think that's important to say. In nursing, or you have the CNA, you have the LPN. I'm not even sure if there's LPNs anymore, but you got the RNs, you got the NPs, and you got the doctors. So while I totally agree that education is really expensive and that everybody only word that's coming up is sponsor each individual who's going to get an education. Like, it doesn't just have to be mental health providers or healthcare providers that's out there helping those in the community who can come to the aid of someone who's having a mental health distress.
Well, and Dr. Clark, as I turn to you for some thoughts on this, there is a... I'm on the fence about reading this email, but I think it is representative of some of the population who is maybe not on board or seeing things a different way. I think we should air this out. So Diane emails to say, maybe the black community needs to encourage some of their own to get trained for these occupations if all the white practitioners are racist. I didn't hear, but let me read the rest of Diane's email. Diane says that if there's one thing that characterizes the guests you have on the show, it's a lack of any mention of personal responsibility. Apparently, if you're black or brown, you have absolutely no obligation to do anything for yourself. All you need to do is blame everybody else, especially white people. Okay, let's air this out, Dr. Clark. I mean, Diane is not the only one who feels that. I know, Diane's not the only one who feels that way. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, we don't have that long.
I know, I know it.
And I can't medicate myself before I answer, but I will try to be moderate in my answer. It's a very difficult question to hear as a black woman, especially because those of us on this call have beaten the odds. We've done the work. We've achieved in our respective fields, and it took a lot of people to get me where I am. It took not only, you know, my family, it took a lot of shoulders, a lot of generations to stand on to get here. And and part of that are some our white allies. So I think it's a misconception or a lack of understanding of what we're talking about to say that we are stating that there are no white allies. We're not saying that at all. Most of us have been quoting studies that have shown that there is an improved health outcome. And I can talk about one, for instance, from an economics journal that talked about black men being more likely to take advice from black male physicians when given preventive medicine types of advice. So, you know, there's studies, and even before the studies, we knew this. I think it's concerning in this day and age that people will ignore the hundreds of years of abuse that have occurred to Black people. You know, I've talked about some of them already, the inhumane experimentation that occurred on Black people, the generations of physical and mental trauma that have been laid down on Black people. And frankly, I think it is just an absolute miracle and triumph that we are as good as we are right now. And so I'm trying not to find offense in what was said, but it is very hard when we have done the work. And the problem is when systems are set up so that you cannot achieve, when systems are set up, you know, we're just talking about this, for instance, in medical practice, in terms of who gets to be a doctor. You know, the tests that are administered have been found to be biased. Many schools are doing away with some of these biased tests. They put emphasis not on the skills that people may have who would be great doctors, but the skills they decide are important that they achieve in to get the doctors that they feel should be doctors. I'm probably not saying that very clearly. But, you know, one thing that Black and Latino people may excel in above white people may be issues of culture and relational abilities, but those are not necessarily valued when you're looking for the next medical school candidate. You know, it's more who's best at chemistry as opposed to who's best at collaboration. So we've spent a lot of time building systems that select people to achieve certain levels in our society that are white. You know, that is just this is the way it is. And I think we're also confused when we talk about what is racist and what is racism. And I just, you know, my name's not Ibram Kendi, but I would suggest that you think about reading his book about how to be an anti-racist. And I think you may feel less accused of being racist and understand that there's a lot of things that go into making racist policy and racist action. So I can't monopolize the time for my colleagues, but you know, I would hope that, you know, maybe start reading some more literature about racism and about how racist policy creates the conditions we're in that might help make an informed listener.
Yeah,
but I'll leave it right there.
Well, and Dr. Clark, let me just say, you are more gracious, I mean, than I think so many would be. And I'm just going to briefly read a remark that I just got texted privately that says, Diane believes in meritocracy but ignores the systems which prevent people from having a chance to be successful. Also, Black folks have to stop being asked to provide rational responses to irrational questions posed by racists. And so I think I'm just going to leave it there and just say to Diane, I really try as the host of this program to understand where people are, how they arrive at their conclusions or what might move them. But I think there was something really just dark and kind of nasty in this idea that our guests are saying that no one should ever have personal responsibility or accountability. I mean, nobody has said that. But there is a call for empathy and understanding. I mean, how do you look at the Daniel Prude response and say, you know, that people who were laughing responded appropriately? I know the attorney said that yesterday, and I'd love to talk to them about it, but no. So, Diane, I mean, I'll follow up with you briefly, but I don't think it's fair for me to direct the rest of our guests to respond to that. And I will ask Dr. McIntosh maybe to just, in our last minute, maybe offer some closing thoughts that you want to leave with us from the Black Healers Network as we talk about the kinds of changes that might actually bring about the progress that you're hoping to see.
Yeah, and I would just echo that, you know, in terms of, you know, a little bit of Diane's comment, in terms of taking personal responsibility, that's why we're also asking to be at these tables, because we know what our community needs and we're trying to get there, but we can't do that if we're not at these tables. So, you know, like I said, so in terms of coupling our knowledge with our lived experience, we want to be at those tables, helping to design policies, procedures, and evaluating these programs so we can get to the bigger vision, systematically change the system so we can improve health for Black and Brown communities.
The Black Healers Network is working on these many issues and have called on public leaders to address them in various ways. And we will continue these conversations because, as some of our listeners have noted this hour and some of our guests, these will be challenging. They will at times be complex, but that doesn't mean that they're impossible. And let's continue those conversations. Dr. McIntosh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Clark, greatly appreciate the insight. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Felicia Reed Watts, so much appreciate your time. Thank you for being with us. And Khadija Tillman, thank you, Khadija. Thanks for making the time for the program.
Thank you.
Members of the Black Healers Network here. Our thanks to Megan Mack, producing and engineering today. I'm Evan Dawson. Just a reminder, if you're listening live at 1:58 p.m. on this Friday, in about 2 minutes, we're going to join a news conference with Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley regarding the conclusion of an investigation into campaign finance allegations regarding Mayor Lovely Warren. That's coming up. Otherwise, we will talk with you back here on Monday on member-supported public radio.